Hello and welcome to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. My name is Molly Ray and I am here with Wayne Johnston with his soon to be available book / memoir called Jenny's Boy. Hello, Wayne. It's great to meet you.
Hi, Molly. Nice to meet you.
And then where are you calling in from?
I'm in what I call my bunker in Toronto right now. It's very quiet down here. So it's where I write and where I actually, strangely enough, it's been where I've been sleeping for the past few days because they're doing construction on the road outside my house.
Mm. So
I haven't been able to sleep or write anywhere except down here in what I call the bunker.
Hmm. That's interesting visuals. I kind of like that though.
Yeah.
Quietness is imaginable. So I guess we could start talking about, this is an autobiographical book and it's one of a couple that you've done. Would you like to share some details or exciting things about the plot with us?
Yeah, it's a memoir. It's the story of my eighth year growing up in Newfoundland, the most easterly province of Canada. And I lived in the most easterly part of that province, so way out in the North Atlantic. I think everyone, when they're a child, thinks their childhood is exceptional. That notion is something that I still have because I'm pretty sure that my childhood was exceptional. This book tells the story of one of the places that I lived in and the story of how I kind of survived the year while living there. My family and I, we used to move almost two or three times a year. For reasons that when I was 7, 8 years old, I didn't understand. We would just be settled into a house and we'd come home from school and find a moving truck in the yard and realize that we were moving again, not having been told that morning that we would be moving. So we'd pile into this truck and we'd only drive a couple of miles in the same town that I grew up in Newfoundland. And we'd move into a new house. And that's what happens at the beginning of this book. We move into a new house. And this is kind of where both my very early childhood and my family's history of moving kind of hits, I don't know if rock bottom exactly is right, but mm-hmm. It's a set of circumstances that are quite daunting that we have to overcome in the space of just several months. So that's a kind of pencil sketch of the mm-hmm. book. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I'm going to bring that up again later with the amount of time that you squish into this book. When I'm looking at your other works and investigating them, there seem to be a lot of fiction and short stories, except for this one, and then your other memoir, The Baltimore's Mansion, which also takes place in the area of Newfoundland, right?
Yeah, it does. It's a slightly different area. It does.
Okay. And I wanted to ask, is your writing process / how is your writing process different between writing fiction and then writing nonfiction memoirs?
Well, as you said, I mainly write fiction. But when I'm writing fiction, for whatever reason, this is how I started out, I was still borrowing heavily from my own autobiography. And when I sort of started to run out of adult material, so to speak, for novels, I started to think about writing historical fiction, mm-hmm. which has in common with autobiography a kind of ready-made template. You know, when you write about your childhood, you're writing about things that actually happened. You don't have to do research because it's all in your head, or hopefully it is. Mm-hmm. When you write historical fiction, again, you're writing about things that really happened, although if you're writing modern historical fiction, you are probably amending the history in some way. But again, you have that template, you have that blueprint already there. Mm-hmm. So that part of the method is the same. But when I'm writing nonfiction, which I've only done twice, what I find with both books is that it's kind of like going into a closet that's full of papers that haven't been sorted by an archivist.
Mm.
And somewhere in there is a story, if you can find it, and if you're patient enough to look for it. That's especially true with narrative nonfiction, you know, as opposed to sort of autobiographies that are kind of a series of name dropping, you know,
yeah.
This is who I met, this is who I had dinner with, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I did with Jenny's Boy. It was very intense. Most people, I think, don't have occasion to recall their past in great detail. Maybe if they're in therapy or something, they do. But even then, mm-hmm. childhoods are things that it takes quite a lot of investigating to get into. Photographs, for instance, that you appear in that you don't remember ever having been taken,
mm-hmm.
or you look nothing like you remember looking. No one else looks like you remember them looking. And so it's a journey back, and you take that journey, the same journey the reader takes, I took in writing the first draft, because everything, although it had happened, seemed fresh, because I couldn't remember some of those details I found in the photographs. So it was very intense, very emotional going through the first draft. And then the sort of more artful side of writing took over in the subsequent drafts. And I especially did want to write a narrative
mm-hmm.
memoir rather than one that kind of gambled about, you know. In the subsequent drafts, it became similar to writing fiction.
Okay.
That's something we can get into if we have a chance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to ask you, and you kind of went into it, like what that journey and process was like going into such an acute piece of your childhood and history. And then everything is very fast. You know, it's only like a year or two from, I think
it's actually 6 months.
6 months. Yeah. Yeah. Because it went so fast and it was so much content and it was only 6 months of your life.
Yeah. I was lucky with, I don't even know who preserved all the photographs that I used for inspiration and for detail. You know, it's mm-hmm. not often you can say with your hand on your heart that when you were 6 years old, you wore a certain kind of shirt, you know.
yeah.
But I can, because the, you know, even on the cover, there's a photograph of me that I don't remember having been taken.
Mm-hmm.
So parading through all those photographs, not just of me, but of my four brothers, of my parents as they were back then, looking
mm-hmm.
so young, much younger than I am now. It was, as I said, a very sort of emotionally intense, often very, very funny. I remembered comic things from a childhood that at the time didn't always seem comic, but in retrospect, I have a better context to see them in. And especially certain characters, I don't want to sort of steal a march on your questions, but you know, certain characters like my grandmother, Lucy, mm-hmm. Who in this book lives just across the road from our house. She basically, you know, in that eighth year of my life, kind of saved my life, I think. That's how I look at it. But I had no idea at that time that anything like that was going on. But she was one of the funniest people that I remember meeting ever in my life. And I know about her in the kind of detail that I write about, because so many other people that I knew growing up after she was gone had known her and had anecdotes to tell about her, and anecdotes to tell that it had occurred between her and me that I didn't remember. And so, you know, I called on family memory as my own to write the book.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating too, because, you know, we really do kind of choose what we experience and see to an extent, and we're completely out of control, out of anything else. And so history that's kind of happening around you that you don't even register, going back to that and processing that. Like, yeah, my family took a lot of pictures too. And I think I'll randomly get texts with pictures that I've never seen before when they're digging through a box that I'm at work, and all of a sudden I'm just like, oh, my heart. Of like a surprise and emotion that can just blow through you from a picture is so real. And so studying deeply, that's a lot of energy, I can only imagine. And so in saying that, there's so much in this 6 months of this book. Is there more that you think you need to tell? Do you want to tell more from after that period, or more from before that period? Like,
yeah, you know, I think over the past few years, I've started to realize that I won't be able to write every book I want to write. You know, sooner or later, everyone runs out of time. And I think of the books that I have, someone once said to me recently, actually, or I asked them, you know, it was another writer. I said, are you working on a book? And she said, no, I don't have an idea for a novel now. And it just struck me that I have never been without an idea for a novel. And you know, anyone who's ever watched airplanes land at an airport, you can, you know, if it's a major airport, you can see them all stacked up, the lights coming toward the airport. They're all of different sizes. So the, you know, the ones closest are biggest, and then you go back and you see this little pinprick of a light that's like a star, and that's coming. And that's how I see all the books I want to write. You know, they're all coming into land, but I don't know when one is going to appear in the sky that will actually never get there, you know?
Hopefully you never crash.
I hope they don't crash land.
well, that's amazing. And I'm sure that can be very almost overwhelming to have that foresight of wanting to get all of that done. So I'm glad that you have the ambition that you do, because there's also people that have all those ideas and, you know, they never get to it, even though they want to so bad. You know, I've definitely been guilty of that.
I was told years ago, you know, if you want to be a writer, write your books. Don't talk about them until they're finished. Because if you talk about them, you might talk them out, and the inspiration for them might diminish or go away entirely. So I followed that advice. You know, knowing ahead of time that you have books you want to write takes a lot of pressure off, because writers are always wondering, what do I do next? And their readers want to know what's coming next, you know? So it's a great thing to get you out of bed in the morning, you know? There's no languishing when it comes to, at least in my sort of view of writing.
That's good. Let's see. I want to talk, obviously, I told you I have a cat. The cat is so cute because it's almost a little, it's so sweet how you have this relationship, this like distant relationship with this little cat named Murchie. Is that how you say that? Mm-hmm. Murchie, that lives with your grandma Lucy. And it's like this little friend, but you never really get to interact with it that much. But the cat kind of followed the timeline of the book to the end. And you put that in there so deliberately. Do you want to talk about that? Just because, you know.
Yeah. Murchie was what I think of as my first pet. Mm. Because we couldn't literally afford a pet. And I don't think my parents especially wanted, one more responsibility, given that they had four boys in quick succession.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went across the road, you know, I was so sick I couldn't go to school, and I would my mom used to teach me at night, and then by day I would go across the road to my grandmother Lucy's house, and she had what had been a barn cat. Mm-hmm. But now domesticated. So it was a huge cat. I don't know what kind, but, you know, imagine something the size of a Maine Coon cat, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, for me, I think of him as kind of, you know, the proto cat. He was, you know, the first cat. Mm-hmm. And in the book, and I had no idea that this would be the case when I started out, but in the book, what I came to realize was that Murchie kind of links my grandparents. They were very sort of, you know, in the old-fashioned rural tradition of, you know, the woman taking care of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, the money and everything else. And the man, in this case, Ned, my grandfather, taking care of his farm. They were both so, you know, exhausted most of the time that Ned especially almost never spoke. He literally almost never spoke to me. So the Murchie would make an appearance during the day from time to time when Ned was having lunch. Mm-hmm. And he would always look as though he was about to pounce on my grandfather, which would not have been a good idea for either one of them. He keeps going in the book like that. And I realized that it was something, one of the rare things they shared, that they didn't talk about him that much. Ned didn't talk about him at all. But by the time you get to the book, the end of the book, Murchie has achieved a kind of status in Ned's life that, mm-hmm. was real, it actually happened, but that I don't think anyone could have foreseen. And I don't want to give memoir, I don't want to give the ending away.
Yeah.
But you know, he plays a big part in it.
You know? Yeah, I know that was very surprising. You know, I think that was like a very good and lovely treat at the end, where I was just like, oh. So then I think I do think we would have time. We have like, I don't know, 8 minutes. Do you want to read a little chunk? Like,
sure. Sure, I can read a little bit. This is a section where I go across the road to Lucy's house. It's the first time I've seen her in quite a while.
Okay.
She's been sick and I haven't seen her, and I've been sick and therefore she hasn't seen me. So I arrive at the house, and this is how it goes. I arrive, by the way, with what's called my bedmobile, which I would carry around, push around with me from place to place, because often I didn't have enough energy to stand. So she says to me as I come in the house, "There he is with his contraption," she said. "You're like the sick in the Bible who carry their pallets around with them." Mm-hmm. She got up and crossed the kitchen floor, put her hands on my shoulders, and looked down at me. Do I look like I've been sick? She said. She didn't, so I shook my head. You look like you are sick, she said. Mind you, if you didn't, I'd think there was something wrong with you. Lucy's eyes were as dark as burnt raisins. Her eyebrows were almost as dark, but her hair was white and had been since she was 40, mid-length and curled under at the sides. We began the day as we had each day I had ever spent at her house, with her making me a glass of quick. I had some, and then she shouted, "Stop," after I'd had about three gulps. She took the glass from me, put it in the fridge, and put a saucer on top. There must be something very special in quick if someone as picky as you can stomach it, she said. Still, at that wedding feast in the Bible, where Christ changes the water into wine when they run out, he wouldn't have made much of an impression if he'd gone round spooning quick into everybody's glass, even though it would have been a miracle because there was no quick back then. A miracle per se is not enough. It has to be something good. If all he'd known how to perform were miracles that made things worse, he would have been hard put to find 12 apostles for the Last Supper. Oh, that's a sin for me, she said, and crossed herself.
Yeah.
That's kind of a little snapshot of Lucy, mm-hmm. her irreverence. She was very Catholic, but she didn't go to church. She kind of said a kind of liturgy for herself and was kind of a satirist of Catholicism, which I kind of in some ways turned out to be myself.
Mm-hmm. And it gives a good example of like this eerie atmosphere of blasé about the illness that was very present with you and also like present within the family at certain times. And it's just like, it became humor at a certain point, and you're 8 years old and there's this sense of humor being thrown around about this. And I can't imagine that's pretty intense, even though it's so delicate in the conversations that come through.
Yeah, you know, we didn't have a lot, but like a lot of other people who don't have a lot, mm-hmm. We had our sense of humor, we had our wit. I mean, you know, if you're poor, you always have whatever you were born with. Mm-hmm. And we were all born with the gift of gab, and we were all born with a sense of irony, a sense of humor. And it could get quite, although intense, quite hilarious at the dinner table when we all, you know, we were kind of making fun of the terms of our existence as a way of coping, I guess, and as a way of getting on each other's nerves, and you know, like any family, but intensely so with us. And even today, one of my brothers is deceased, but even today, when we all get together, if there are other guests around, they are sort of overwhelmed into silence as we sort of, you know, kibitz back and forth, you know. it's just the way we are.
Yeah, I love that. I'm hopeful that I do get some of that in my family settings, and I'm grateful for the bits of that I have. I'm going to ask the last question here, and so this book is coming out in next month, but would you please give us some more details about how listeners can learn more about your book and then at the same time prepare to get themselves a copy if they want to do so?
Yeah, if they want to learn more about the book, they're, you know, in advance, the best thing they can do is go to my website. So that's Wayne Johnston, make sure of the T, so waynejohnston.ca. And you can find out there all of the books I've written, places you can get them. You'll find out the exact publication date of Jenny's Boy. You'll find out what Audible and ebook editions they're in, and you know, the you can you'll readers will be able to find them in, you know, as the saying goes, you know, wherever fine books are sold, which in this day and age is on Amazon, but also, you know, at bigger stores, chain stores like Barnes and Noble, and also in independent bookstores. I would say probably especially in independent bookstores in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely have a lot in Minneapolis. So January, and you said, is it the 23rd?
Yeah.
Okay, so
February.
Post-February 23rd. That's when they can be ready for that. Well, that's really exciting. You know, that was, I read the book a little while ago, and so I'm glad that it was, you know, it stayed fresh in the mind, and it was really lovely, incredibly lovely talking to you about it. And
talking to you.
Thanks. I'll probably have to dig out and find some more works of yours. With that, I guess I have to, I'm going to close this down. And so I wanted to thank everybody for listening to Write On Radio with Wayne Johnston and I about his upcoming book, Jenny's Boy. If there's anything else you wanted to say for a second, Wayne, welcome to.
Just that, although it's a memoir, it is a sort of narrative-driven memoir. It's kind of an idea that I'm driving home. Mm-hmm. My, you know, I think among memoirs, it's kind of rare to have one that narrative-driven, and mm-hmm. it's not because I forced it that way. It happened that 1 year had that shape naturally, and so I guess I was just lucky.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you. And once again, this is Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. And next is this.